Blog Talk Radio.
This is our 300th broadcast of the Eastern Radio Show. Happy New Year, Eastern family and friends. You're listening to the radio voice of Eastern Airlines, and we're glad you're here with us tonight, 2 weeks into the new year, 2017. My name is Chuck Albright. I'm sitting in for Jim Hart tonight, and I'm one of the hosts that brings you this show every Monday all through the year, nearly 6 years now. Wow. Just as a reminder about how to sign into the show and call in, if you have comments or join the host, here we need to have you with us. Go to www.ealradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the home page. Click the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer. You can also tune in by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. This site is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio. Now, there's an easy way. Just call 213-816-1611 at 7 Eastern Standard Time, and you can listen in right on your phone. You can also join in the conversation by saying, "Hi," and we want to hear from you. Now, let's get this episode in the air for another wonderful year talking about Eastern Airlines and its people. Dorothy.
Flight attendants, prepare for departure, please. Captain, we have completed the cabin departure announcements and we're secure for departure.
Dorothy, thank you very much. And Don, would you let LaGuardia Tower know that we're ready for takeoff?
Sure, Captain. I wonder if they've noticed our new equipment. LaGuardia Tower, Eastern 300 Heavy is ready for takeoff.
Roger, Eastern 300 Heavy. This is a new aircraft you guys are flying. Sure is shiny and big, and with three engines.
Yeah, we wondered if you would notice our newest set of wings. It's the Lockheed L-1011. We're the first to take delivery of this Lockheed TriStar, as Lockheed calls it. Eastern calls it the Whisperliner. We received the first delivery May 5th, 1972. The engines are three Rolls-Royce RB211, delivering 42,500 pounds of thrust each. That's a total of 127,500 pounds of total thrust. It's like flying a hotel. We've got a full load of passengers today, 316 to be exact. It's classified as wide-body aircraft. Our total takeoff max weight is 430,000 pounds. We have about 50 of these on order. Between here and Miami, we offer movies in both first class and coach. Today, we are a crew of three up front and 10 cabin members.
It sure is a large aircraft to be operating out of LaGuardia. The winds here are 320 at 10 knots, and you're cleared for takeoff on runway 31.
Roger, LaGuardia, Eastern 300 heavy. Confirm runway 31, and we're ready on the roll.
Eastern, this is Delta right behind you. It sure is a beautiful aircraft on that takeoff.
Thanks, Delta, and it's really fun to fly.
Has the right time and the right place for you. It's still very early into our new year, folks, 2017, and we'd like to hear from you, our listeners and hosts, about what's on your mind. What plans have you made? What 2016 stories you would like to tell us about? What do you consider to be the single biggest aviation story of the last year? That'd be interesting to talk about. What are your thoughts about the recent breach in security at the Fort Lauderdale International Airport? That's current events. What changes should be made in airport security? These are just a few topics we want to throw out tonight and we might want to discuss. And would any of our hosts or listeners like to open the microphone here at the EAL radio show? Before we do, I would like to say that we lost a very dear friend and host this past week, and my best friend, Howard Mucci. Howard passed away Thursday morning at about a little bit before 8 o'clock when his wife was preparing to take him to the Mayo Clinic, as his doctor wanted him there early Thursday morning at 9 o'clock. And Lou, Howard's wife, had him in the car and never made it out of the driveway. Howard died quickly in the car without any pain, just passed away sitting in the passenger seat. He was a very dear friend, but there was a lot about the man that he never mentioned. Dorothy put together a little piece that we've got on the website, a little tribute to Howard, and I'd like to read what she has found about Howard. Of course, I could talk a long, long time about Howard, because we've been friends for, golly, I guess nearly 20 years, and we worked together, and he's given me a lot of advice for the radio show and a lot of other things, and it seems like after every Monday night show, I would always talk to Howard and say, you know, Howard, you got to help me think of something else to do next Monday. And on about three or four occasions, Howard suggested that we might want to look at his little book that he wrote about little stories throughout his life that he thought important. He was a good writer. He was a very brilliant man. So I took his advice, and a lot of suggestions kind of came from Howard, kind of reminded me of Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone, where Rod Serling got a lot of his stories from his brother, Robert Serling, the author. But Howard was a very dear friend of mine, and we had every Tuesday morning, we had breakfast at the Beach Diner, and then on Thursday, we would have breakfast at Panera Bread. And this particular Thursday was the last that Howard made it, and we did not have our breakfast, but he had planned to have a breakfast, but he called me the night before saying that he had been advised to go to the Mayo Clinic. But Howard was the president of a company called Universal Scientific, which is one of the largest manufacturers of printed circuit boards in the Midwest. He had an exceptional background, and for the past 18 years that Howard used his impressive background and the advantages it offered, and was instrumental in the sale of over 100 small and large businesses. That's where I got to know Howard, because I did sell small businesses, and Howard put his real estate license with my company. And in addition to that, Howard also performed appraisals for small Midwestern banks involving loan qualifications. Howard graduated a long, long time ago, because Howard died at 95. This month, the 20th of January, he would have been 95 years old. He graduated from Brooklyn Polytech Institute with a chemical engineering degree, and he later received a Master's of Science degree from Seton Hall University in Business Management. He held various top management positions, including companies that manufacture electronic products ranging from radio tubes and relays to printed circuit boards used in many products. Howard was an inventor, and he has some 12 patents to his credit. And he had written various technical papers for the Institute of Printed Circuits. He retired, devoting his time to charitable work along with his hobbies of fishing. And fishing with Neil, I hope. He did a lot of that when we had the weather was going our way. And so we did go out on Tuesdays, and more than catch fish, we drank a beer together and talked about stories, mostly about Howard. And because he had a lot of stuff that he could offer me, and I was trying to pick up on anything that he mentioned that would be worthy of a radio show, and there were many. Howard's latest book is All the Stories from Here and There, which is a potpourri of stories written over a period of time about the places Howard and his wife Lou have been, as well as situations that Howard found himself in during his travels. There are a few autobiographical stories about growing up and stories about family situations, as well as some about individuals that Howard has known. And it also encompasses quite a few stories about his unique business experiences. Howard resided until his death with his wife Lou and their cat Maxie. And a recent addition to the family was a beautiful long-haired dachshund called Kayla. And that seemed to give them a lot of comfort there in a retirement village in Jacksonville, Florida. So I will miss Howard greatly. And I would miss his counseling with our radio show and his appearances on our radio show. His voice has been on many of our parts that we had he couldn't participate most of the time in the last few years, couple of years. He preferred to record it and then send it to me as an MP3 file, and I inserted it right into the cast. And I don't think many people caught the fact that it was recorded and Howard wasn't live with us. But Howard, you will be missed by all of us here at the radio show. And Lou, I know you listen on occasions to our archive versions of this radio. We'll be with you in thought and prayer, and also I'll be with you anytime you need me. So, Howard, so long. And thanks, listeners, for listening to this. Now, let's get to our radio show. Any comments about the passing of Howard? If you would like to make your expression, I'd be happy to hear from you now.
Well, this is Chuck, and I want to kind of digress here about the Fort Lauderdale incident about security. I had run into that years ago. I was in the Eastern Airlines Gun Club and a couple other gun clubs throughout the years. And, of course, this was back a ways, a few years back. And we were allowed to put our guns in our luggage, but we couldn't put the ammunition. We had to either ship it, or when we got to the place where we were going to have our competition, then we would either buy it from somebody who's already loaded it for you, or you'd have to commercially buy it somewhere that was on the field that they set up tents and stuff. But I can see what happened, that this person who put this gun and ammunition together, I don't see how that they would allow both of them to be shipped in the same container. That's what I can't understand. He intercepted it, of course. But it's just beyond me that they would allow that to happen. I can see you shipping one and I can see you shipping another, because they ship ammunition all over the country. I mean, the people that sell it to gun owners and sportsmen alike, and even to the people who sell it to you commercially and some of the stores and stuff. I mean, you can go to any of the sporting goods stores and obviously buy ammunition. Well, that ammunition is shipped to them a lot of times by air. But that's my comment on it. I think it was a great lax, and somebody's looking out for the general public that they would allow both the gun and the ammunition in the same area. Does anybody else have something about that?
Well, actually, Chuck, he had two suitcases, and one was in one suitcase and one was in the other.
Yeah, but we weren't even allowed to do that back in the old days. I mean, you could ship the gun in your suitcase, but you couldn't put your ammunition anywhere else. It had to be commercially shipped.
That's correct.
Yeah, I guess
they should probably go back to that.
That's correct.
Nothing else. And probably,
you know, like UPS or Federal Express or somebody like that, if you wanted your own personal ammunition. I personally got to know a couple of guys, and I never shipped any ammunition anywhere. I used to go to the meets, and I would buy from the guys who had already made them up for you, because the gun I had was quite powerful, and I had to have a certain amount of grains in the shells. So I guess the law allows him to do that, you know. I think the law should be changed where you couldn't do that. You can do one or the other, but you couldn't do both.
Well,
because
be
that had to go through kind of
Dorothy?
Security, an X-ray machine, right?
Well, they had known that he had it. It just was in two separate containers or two separate bags. The thing is, maybe they should start to establish a new ruling of any guns that you want to bring with you have to be shipped separately. Shipped to where you're going, shipped to your destination. Now, all that does is bear the burden on wherever it's being shipped to, because if you're going to a hotel and you have it shipped to the hotel, you're still going to have it at the hotel, and you still have another chance of someone going off their rocker and, you know, doing some damage somewhere else. But at least it wouldn't be at the airport with all of the planes that are there and the people that come. They said there was like 800 to 1,000 daily at Fort Lauderdale that take off from there.
Like a shooting gallery.
And some of the witnesses that you saw, how he was so steady in what he was doing. He didn't say anything. He wasn't screaming. He wasn't yelling. He just knelt to the floor and he took his aim. And shooters, especially in the service, aren't taught to just hit somebody and wound them. They're shot to kill. So there you have 5 people that died and 8 that were wounded and 50 others that got hurt with all the trampling around that everybody was doing.
You know, how can you really protect the public? How can you really protect the public?
You can't.
When anyone that really wants to do what this guy did, whether it's in a theater or a football stadium or a basketball stadium or airport or whatever, what's to prevent? I mean, how do you prevent that? And I know it seems like there are a lot of missed opportunities of getting these guys before the fact, because this guy had been, and it seems like lots of others that have been involved in these these crimes, that they have information about these people, their background, and I don't know. It just will we ever be able to stop this type of thing?
Probably not.
So many privacy laws, too. It's like if this guy had psychological evaluation, you could say that was up to the doctors that were evaluating to send notice around to anyone that would have a need to know, being airlines or any public transportation, that if this guy has any type of a weapon or a license for a weapon, or even if you sent it to dealers and left it up to the dealers to contact people. I mean, it has to, somehow or another, it's got to be brought forward one step or two steps more than it is now, because obviously it's not working. It hasn't worked all the way along the line, really, when you stop and think about it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had 9/11 and all of that, and people on planes and taking over planes. And so it's something that... It needs more thought put into it. It needs more people to get on the bandwagon.
George, have you ever thought about writing a novel about something like this?
No, I haven't, Neil. It's actually, to me, it's a little bit depressing. And the reason I say that is because this is a recent phenomena. And, you know, I mean, back when we were flying, you know, this never even entered your mind. I mean, the worst thing that ever happened, if you recall, at Eastern, would be a hijacker would come up to the cockpit and threaten people, if we didn't take them to Cuba. But, you know, other than that, I don't recall many incidents other than like the one with Bob Wilbur, where anyone truly got hurt. But today it seems to be like a weekly occurrence. So What I'd like to know is why. What is the reason, the recent reason behind this entire rash of things of this nature?
You don't have ISIS. That's what you didn't have.
Well, no, but this guy he wasn't Middle Eastern, and you know, I mean, it just I don't know. It just it.
I think he used I think he used that Middle Eastern or ISIS as just an excuse. To me, in my mind,
yeah,
I don't think that.
I think you're right, Neil. I think it was just an excuse.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems like to me, airport security, if you wanted to get weapons in there to harm the public, all you have to do is just sit down and plan it. And just like folks have done.
That's what I'm referring to, Neil. I mean, if you recall, it wasn't in the too distant past when, for example, the shuttle, there was no security, and the lines would extend outside the hangar at LaGuardia and up in Boston, you know, outside the terminal.
Yeah.
And people would just get on the airplane. There was no security because there was never this type of a problem that existed. And so the question in my mind is what precipitated this all of a sudden? And it's come about. I mean, 9/11 was the big one that took us all by surprise, but it's been ever since then. And it's just, I don't know, I find it to be very troubling because what's the rationale behind it? That's the question.
George and Steve, what's your thoughts about flying in the environment that these pilots and flight attendants have to work in a closed, confined environment like an airplane cabin at 40,000 feet in the air and things like this? You know, I don't know what are the pilots feeling today about this? What's your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I mean, when we flew, you know, Steve and I have both been out of the business for a while, as you have, Neil. And, you know, when we flew, you're worried about, well, you know, what are we going to do on the layover? What's the weather like? What's the fuel? Now, you know, you add to the stress factor, you know, a double-locked cockpit door that nobody can get in or out of. You know, the feeling is there's some crazy person back there. I mean, it just, to me, it adds to the stress level needlessly. And I don't know if there is an answer to it without trampling upon certain civil rights that we have. I don't know. I mean, heck, if I had that answer, or if any of us did, we'd probably be in the White House instead of Mr. Trump waiting to go in there, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know back in 1963...
You've got the answers either.
Back in 1963, I flew a Convair 440 flight. I remember the flight number 687, Eastern 687. From Miami and winding up from Washington, D.C. to Miami, Florida. And on the first leg from Washington to Raleigh, North Carolina, we had the president's wife of Vietnam, Madame Nu. And the president of Vietnam was, I think his first name was Sigmund. I want to say Sigmund or something like that, Nu. And his wife was over here for the purpose of delivering a speech at the University of North Carolina. And we had her on board with her daughter. She was on television, I think even on Johnny Carson's show, or lots of TV exposure that she was trying to accomplish to keep our troops in Vietnam. And this was in the early 60s now. And we were advised by the company that there possibly was a bomb on board our airplane, on our airplane. Now, the thoughts that came to my mind when I was told that was I was almost in near panic. I didn't want to show that because I was a brand new co-pilot on probation. And so I didn't say much, but I certainly thought about it. I really did. When the company tells you that there possibly is a bomb on the airplane because it had been called in that the airplane had a bomb on it. And so when we got in range at Raleigh, the company gave us a place to park the Convair away from the terminal. So we thought it was pretty serious the whole time. But in my mind, in my thoughts, my feelings, was in the air before we ever landed, when is this thing going to blow up? You know, when am I not going to live anymore? And, you know, thoughts like that kind of race through your mind, and it's a funny feeling. It really is. To make a long story short, we parked on the other side of the field, the fixed base operator, and sure enough, the folks followed us that were in protest to the Vietnam War. And when we offloaded, of course, we didn't have jetways back in those days. When they offloaded Madam New and her daughter, the students at the college had gathered eggs and tomatoes and things like that, and they threw as far as they could throw to possibly show their protest of her being here in America. And that was my first feeling of, what could possibly be a bomb in the air. And, of course, I had two other occasions, but I don't want to talk about that tonight. But anyhow, it is a feeling, and I wonder how these pilots and flight attendants feel about what's going on in our environment of the airplane in the airport terminal these days.
I think you can keep thinking about that, though, or you wouldn't be doing your jobs, because it's no matter where you go, it's police officers, it's everyone that's in law enforcement. If they thought the same way, we wouldn't have anybody defending us. I think it's something you have to let go and just hope to God you're not in a situation that's going to happen when you're around. John, a few weeks ago, went to the post office, and as he was coming out, he saw all these fire trucks coming in to where the post office is. He couldn't imagine what was going on. And as he got home, he saw on TV that the post office, they thought they had some white powder in the back room or something in a package. And it turned out it wasn't. But, you know, you just say, my God, I just left there. I could have been in there.
Yeah.
I could have, you know. And same thing with us going down to Fort Lauderdale. We planned to go down on Friday to Fort Lauderdale. And Dom was going to go around the parking lot, drop me off in front of Terminal 2 so I could go downstairs where it happened at the Delta. And right next in that same area is the currency exchange. And I was going to change the money we had from Cuba. Well, as it turned out, when I get up late because I was up late at night. And when I went in, Don had fallen asleep in his chair, and I thought, well, we're not going to go today because there's no way I'm going down to Fort Lauderdale in the afternoon. And look what happened. Right in the area where we would have been at that particular time, because that's when we would have been there. So, you know, you just don't know when it's your time for all of this. Just hope to God that you're not around.
You know, the 6:30 national news tonight showed, it was pretty graphic, showed him firing in that baggage area. I thought, you know, they wouldn't do that, but they did. So,
well, someone had a video of that, they said, on TV last night.
Well, you know, you don't hear many incidents. I don't hear any. I haven't heard in a long time any of this happening over in Israel. It seems like to me the Israelis have this security down really tight, and you don't hear much about that. As a matter of fact, Dorothy, you sent me an article about that, about the way the Israelis handle their security.
But, you know, with all of the many planes that leave and the mounds of people that are at the airport, to detain everybody before they even cross into the airport area, that's a massive job. No matter how much or how many you would have of troops or armed men, stopping, checking cars. Look at the time that it would take and how long is it going to take anybody to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. What it does is impact everybody from going anywhere or doing anything, and you start to get so paranoid with everything that you do. Can you really get into anything like that? Can you do any more than what you're really doing and just hope that there isn't someone that's a little bit sick that has this happen to them? And, you know, we have tons of Vietnam vets out there that have been over in wars and have had come back with all kinds of issues. You just don't know when, God forbid, they're going to snap and go. So how can you protect yourself in every instance? It's almost impossible.
Well, yeah. You know, Neil, what I like to call this today is the age of anxiety. And if you think back, it really started right around the mid-70s, and it's only gotten worse. I mean, it might not even be conscious, but it's subconscious, where you might look at certain people certain ways where before you would never even give it a thought. And
right.
So, yeah, I just like to call it the age of anxiety because that's what we're living in right now.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. You said the middle 70s. That's when Peggy and I took our first trip over to Europe, and we went to Germany. We landed in Frankfurt before the wall came down, of course, and we landed in Frankfurt, and when we got home after that wonderful trip of driving around Germany, and all of a sudden, right after we got home, it seemed like that incident there at the airport terminal in Frankfurt, where they had the terrorists that went in there and just mowed everybody down, and that was in the mid-70s.
Yeah,
you guys recall that?
Was that at the Olympics? Oh, no, that was in Munich.
No. This was in the Frankfurt terminal, the airport terminal there. Yeah.
Well, I was in Athens, Greece. The day after I left, they had a shooting in that terminal. That's in 1972.
Yeah.
But maybe it stems from all these wars that we've had our veterans in and all of the incidents that are going around all over the world. There's always some area that's fighting and shooting, and we seem to be brought into everything, and we're always in places where we go to help people out, but then it ends up, we end up getting some of the repercussions from it because we have taken care of other people in other countries. And so maybe that sick person, you know, just takes it out on everybody else.
George, a suggestion, title for the next book, Age of Anxiety.
Well, believe me, I've given it some thought, but it's really not a very pleasant subject to even write about,
but
no less even think about, you know. I mean, but its effects are felt throughout our society, more so, I mean, even if it's subconsciously by our children and our grandchildren. We were like the first generation to go through it, but it was only for a very small portion of our lives, you know, percentage-wise. But they're going to live with it for their entire lives. And there's a lot that can be done, both good and more importantly, bad, based upon that. And I don't mean bad, you know, just through acts like we've discussed, but I mean different repression of different freedoms. You can go on and on with it. There's a list as long as your arm, and it's extremely sad. And maybe this is the goal of the people who perpetrate these acts. I really don't know.
Well, once they establish probably some more gun laws that it might be tightened with background and anyone having psychological, it's immediately tagged so that everyone is aware that people that sell guns, people that go to sell guns and ammunition to stores, they have all this information available that they can maybe stop one or two or three here or there. It's going to be a very slow process because none of us are geared to have to be restricted from everything that we go to do. I mean, who wants that? But the other hand, where do you start? Where do you stop?
Well, that's what I'm speaking about. If we never had the problem before, And everyone, as we all know, when we were younger, you had access to ready access to guns. Why today? I mean, it's just it boggles my mind. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who are a lot more intelligent than I am or any of us are who've given this a lot of thought. And I certainly don't have the answers. And so far, I don't believe that anyone has come up with the answers.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. You know, we've got so many calls on our, callers on our board now, and all of the microphones are open, folks. So if you'd like to join our conversation, please do. Erico 727, is that you, Bill Joseph?
Hi, Neil, it's Gail.
Hey, Gail, that's right. Both of you have that area code.
Yeah,
so good to hear from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys, flight attendants, talk about this from time to time, Gail?
I was not a flight attendant.
That's right. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But
regarding that security and that shooting, the first thing that came to my mind is that poor man just did not get the help that he wanted from the VA and from the doctors, and that was very sad. That was very sad. And and then the luggage situation with the gun and the ammunition that just blew my mind when I had beer in my suitcase and they took it out. And I just don't understand it. Yeah,
but
the security and everything. It's got to be revisited.
In the security, they had to have a lockbox, and that he did have a lockbox, and he had it in the lockbox. But what happened is he was domestic, so he came out of the doors from the plane, went into the bathroom, which is right there, unlocked his box, got his gun, unlocked his other suitcase, got the bullets, put them together, and that's when he came out and started shooting.
So about
they had done all the right things, and even customs, even though if they saw it, it was in the lockbox the way it should have been. What would stem anybody from not letting it go through? It was done the way it should. He did what he should. So it's the next step that everybody has to take, not the ones we're taking. Obviously, what we're doing isn't enough.
Right.
Well, in this day of technology, as quick as it is advancing, Lord knows what other types of ways that they can do damage to people, no matter where they are, whether it's an airplane or anywhere else. It's just a truly amazing time that we're living in. Time of anxiety. I like that title, George.
Yeah, that really is a nail on the head. Yeah, it really is. I don't even want to travel anymore. I just don't want to do it.
Yeah. Well,
you
my
know,
traveling.
When Donna and I left our car at the terminal, we walked through two terminals, down two banks of elevators, up a flight of escalators. We could have had bombs and everything else in our bag. We could have dropped them there and shot everybody in sight. And who was to think anything of two people like us? And how do you know when you should and shouldn't do something when you should have security elsewhere? I mean, it can get out of hand. There is just no way.
There's times when I'm glad you didn't have a gun, Dorothy.
Well, some of the crew members today, I don't know whether they have guns, but we were allowed to carry them in our day. George and Steve, some of our captains, some of our crew members carried guns in their flight bags, and it was legal. I don't know whether it's legal today to do that by crew members. Is it?
They have to go through some specialized training, and then they can do it. They have to be in a locked box, but then they can bring them into the cockpit. But I recall when I went down to Miami for my interview with Eastern, I was on the DC-8, and I told the flight attendant where I was going and why. And she said, "Oh, why don't you go up and see the captain?" And went up to the cockpit, and somehow the conversation between the captain and the first officer on the DC-8 got around to hijacking to Cuba, and the captain reached over into his bag. He pulled out a .45, and he said, "Well, nobody's taking me to Cuba. I don't want to go there." I said, "Whoa, this is something, you know." But I mean, it was a loaded pistol the guy was carrying around with him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I don't know. Did you say that they are allowed to do that under certain conditions?
Yeah, I believe it's called the Armed Crew Member Act or something like that, where
they have to have training.
The captain or both the captain and the co-pilot, I'm not certain, but they have to go through some type of weapons training, and then they're allowed to bring it with them into the cockpit. Yeah.
And then there's the old crash axe. That's a good weapon. It'll part the hair. And that was another incident that I was involved in Beaumont, Texas, where the captain told the possible person that was about to disturb our flight, and he yelled the crash axe. I said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, if he comes in the cockpit, he's going to receive this." And that was that crash axe. I'll never forget that. That was back in the 60s, too, in the Convair.
Well, I understand that the Israelis and the Russians in their airplanes carry military people with guns.
Well,
am I wrong?
No, we do that also. We have people who ride in the passenger cabin at
air marshals.
Yeah, air marshals, and you know, you just don't know who or where they are. But I mean, I don't know. This guy, what he did in the Fort Lauderdale airport, he could actually have done in Times Square, New York. I mean, there are more people around there than there are in the terminal in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, how do you prevent it? That's the 50-cent question.
Yeah,
I don't think you can.
I agree with that. But there's an underlying reason.
Yeah, go ahead, George. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that there's an underlying psychological reason or reasons why there are so many people out there today doing these type of things, and I don't know what that reason or reasons might be, but it just boggles my mind, you know.
Well, there's a lot of stress in the whole world, and stress doesn't help anybody. It just exacerbates and gets worse.
I think that one of the things is that a lot of these people who commit these crimes are willing to die for it, whereas I think back in the old days when you had these guys do a lot of things, they thought they were going to get away with it and that they weren't going to sacrifice their life. I mean, some of them were, but it seems like a lot of them today, especially when you see the terrorists in other parts of the world, you know, in Germany and France and Belgium and some of those other places where they're killing, you know, a tremendous amount of people, but they're willing to give their lives for this cause, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
We're back in the old days.
But I don't think that was happening. But this most recent case, the guy, I guess when his gun got emptied, he laid on the floor, spread eagle, so he wouldn't get shot or killed. And I don't know. It's insanity, is what it really is.
Doesn't make any sense. No.
Yeah.
The one that needed help, obviously, he's not going to get the death penalty. So.
Oh, no, they'll plead insanity for sure.
Yeah, he'd be lucky if he's overnight in jail in the way they do things today.
I don't know about that. I think he might get a little more than that.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you a little story. I hope it's not too boring, but one of my relatives was renting a house with him and his girlfriend at the time. And they were renting the house from this guy, and they got in a big argument. And this guy went into his room, and he came out with I don't know if you know what it is. It's called a cantata sword. It's a short samurai sword. And my friend went down the hallway to see what was going on, and this guy hit him right in the head. But it veered off and cut most of his ear off. and sliced his arm open, and obviously he lost a lot of blood. And the guy just sat down in his living room because the wife told him to put the knife down, and he called the police. So they hauled him away. He spent 4 days in jail, and he was released with a bracelet around his leg. And then he came back to court, and instead of them pursuing second degree or manslaughter, it was attempted. And what he ended up doing, he had to wear a bracelet for 4 years, and he couldn't leave his county.
That's our laws. That's what we. Yeah.
And
that's
here
what
he is.
For.
He tried to commit murder with a samurai sword.
You know,
that's one of the problems we got.
I have an associate with me, and some of you know him, Emery Martinelli. He's been to our reunions on two occasions, and Emery is a great friend of mine. And Emery, too, would go with Howard and me for breakfast when we had breakfast on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But Emery's country, Turkey, has gone through, we've been reading in the paper recently of all the terrorist activities there and the what's happened there. And he has friends there and family there, and we have these countries that go through these terrible times, and I just wonder, are we going to wind up like this in the future? Is this going to be America here very soon, or do
it
we
very
have
well
someone?
Could be.
Yeah, Emery, you know, talks about his friends, and a lot of his friends are thinking about. As a matter of fact, they're investing in America, bringing their money, and he's helping them get business real estate here. And he is a real estate licensed real estate agent. But I talk to him all the time about what's happening over in Istanbul. That's where he's from. You're talking about America having – We have incidents like what happened in Fort Lauderdale, but golly, Pete, when things like what we've read about countries like Turkey and other countries over there that have experienced what they're experiencing, what's going to happen to America here? I just hope 2017 we have some solutions. I don't think we'll solve this problem, but some solutions and someone that will step up and. Hopefully it's going to be this administration that will do something about it.
Well, I think it's going to be a great improvement over what we've had.
Okay. But I think, like George said, we are living in an age of anxiety. Is that what you said, George?
Yes, I did. I believe that's the truth, you know?
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I hope that we can do something about it. Our leadership and we'll take hold of this situation and I don't know. I guess the only thing we can do is pray about it and hope that, I don't know, we've got to do something about it. It's not coming down from above. It's got to be right here. We've got to take hold of this situation and do something about it. Hey, George, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
George, you
sure.
There?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. What can we expect about, there's so many things that have been going on here lately about Flight 980. It's been in the news. It's, golly, Pete, it's been on television. It's been in Fox has reported it, CBS, ABC have been talking about Flight 980. What can we expect this year?
Well, I think we can expect a lot. And I'm just not at liberty to say yet what that'll be. But I think I do believe that we can expect a lot of movement on it. And at least I'm hoping and praying for that. And right now, it looks like there will be. So we shall see what happens. But
that's great.
There's been a tremendous amount of interest. tremendous.
Well, George, anything that we can do here on the radio show, we'll donate as much time as you want or whatever it takes. Let's see if we can get some answers to what's going on.
That's the key to it. And, you know, whether or not what Dan and Isaac found was the cockpit voice recorder tape or not, you know, only time will tell about that. But, you know, one thing that bothered me was that the NTSB stated that it would take them approximately 3 to 4 weeks in order to see if they could if there was anything worth recovering off that potential cockpit voice recorder tape. But then they said what they were going to do was to send it to the Bolivians. And that kind of bothered me a little bit because the Bolivians, as you know, have never shown the least amount of interest in doing any type of investigation over what happened down there.
Yeah. Well,
do they have to turn it over to the Bolivians?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I could probably answer your question with a question. Let's suppose for a few minutes that they had recovered the cockpit voice recorder tape during the NTSB investigation or trek, you can call it investigation because it was anything but, in October of 1985. Would they have then been obligated to turn over anything that they found to the Bolivians, or would the NTSB have, you know, looked into it and investigated?
Yeah. Good question.
According to who was in power down there in Bolivia?
Well, you know, now they're claiming that they, you know, the Bolivians didn't want to do anything because of Edward Snowden. But my answer to that is, well, really, what happened during the intervening 30 years when absolutely nothing was done?
Nothing. That's right.
I don't know if Bob Furman is online tonight or not, but, you know, he and I discussed this at length yesterday.
No, Bob's not. His area code's not on. I think he's going to be out of town. But you say you discussed, what was the subject of your discussion again?
Well, it was, you know, this entire... the way, you know, the fact that these two fellows found this tape back in May, and here it is January before the NTSB even comes and collects it. I mean, it's crazy. And there were some statements made to Bob by one of the people in the October investigation or the October NTSB trek that were absolutely totally wrong and incorrect. It just boggles my mind that these people think that 32 years later they can get away with it.
Tracy is still very active in trying to have a resolve in this. Mark Bird's daughter,
Stacy.
Stacy, that's I said Tracy. I'm very sorry, Stacy. And I hope we can get a lot of information and maybe a resolution on this year, this coming year. And we'll do everything that we can here on the radio show to keep it in front, right up front, and talk more about this coming year.
Well, I have to tell you, Neil, that Outside Magazine article really moved everything front and center.
And, it sure did.
My thanks to Peter Frick Wright for his story. It was an excellent story, and to Dan and Isaac for going up there. I mean, it was it really exposed a lot of the thing. I mean, a lot of the questions have never been answered, but hopefully, as you mentioned, perhaps this year they will be.
Yeah.
Maybe the reason they waited so long is because they thought it might go away, and somebody's not making it go away.
Oh, undoubtedly. I agree with that. I think that's an excellent perception. I think it's true.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's more likely than not.
Guys, this has been a great discussion tonight. Thanks so much for the discussion on security and 980, of course. And I want to make an announcement about changes that are forthcoming very soon in our EAL radio show website because we have a new webmaster. I wish I had a drum roll for this. A drum roll. Dorothy Gagnon. Dorothy, thanks so much for accepting that awesome responsibility of trying to get the website more organized, more interesting, so that people will say, hey, if I want information about Eastern Airlines, this is where I want to go, EALradioshow.com. And I know that if anyone can do this, Dorothy can. And she is...
Oh, we're sure going to try hard, Neil.
She's so creative. And I know that EARA members of the EARA are going to miss her talents. And what she has done, News Crew, and just a few issues that she's done. And she's going to be a welcome to me and the website. And so expect a lot of things with our website. It's going to be more interactive. Is that the word to use? That
right.
Our people can interact with the website. You know, a Facebook page, and a lot of us are so familiar with Facebook pages, they offer a lot of information about what you have in common, I guess. And but our website offers so much more to our Eastern family. It has so many pages that if I try to do my best in putting it together, but lots of things took my time away from it, that I hope we can have a wonderful media that folks, Eastern folks, can go to and learn so much about and talk to former Eastern people. And I'm sure Dorothy's going to be able to make that happen. So thanks, Dorothy, for volunteering to do that.
You're welcome, Neil.
The pay is high.
Best shot.
So don't ask for a raise real soon.
Okay. I'll be in line after dawn, right?
Yeah, there you go. And I don't know, George, maybe we ought to have a page on 980. That's something that we can talk about, Dorothy.
Yeah,
and,
that's true.
Find out what's going on with 980. So let's keep that in front of Eastern folks and the public. Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah,
a lot
you know,
of things we want
to... You know who I hear from pretty frequently is Larry Campbell's former girlfriend, the girl that he was dating when he flew that trip. And she has still to this day a lot of interest in what had happened. And, you know, she was very unhappy with the fact that, you know, Larry was blamed for the crash when there was absolutely no proof that he was the responsible party for it. And she contacted me through my website, and then, you know, we've spoken a few times on the telephone and via email. And she's subsequently remarried, but she still has a tremendous interest in this. In fact, she spoke with both Dan Futrell and Isaac Stoner after they came back from Bolivia.
Wow.
Okay. Interesting. So we're going to be very interested this year. Let's see if we can find out more about Flight 980, and let's see if we can get to the bottom of this. We want welcome hope that Bob Furman will join us again in our discussions, because he's been so active throughout last year, along with George, and trying to get the information more about what happened and why can't the government be more involved in this. Folks, that's about all the time we have for tonight. And Captain Steve, how about putting Flight 300 Heavy gently back on the ground?
Okay, Neil. LaGuardia Tower, this is Eastern 300 Heavy, and we're just passing a beam of the Statue of Liberty in our new Lockheed TriStar Whisperliner, and we're requesting a visual to runway 4, and we've got in sight.
Eastern Flight 300 Heavy, this is LaGuardia Tower. You're clear to land on runway 4. The winds are light and variable from 060 degrees at 10 miles per hour, and the present temperature at the airport is a chilly 25 degrees.
Roger, LaGuardia Tower, Eastern 300 Heavy is cleared to land on runway 4. Brr.
Steve, how about closing us out tonight?
Okay, Neil.
Great
landing. And that was
by
a great
way.
Landing, even if I say so myself. We had a great show tonight, folks. And Mr.
Excellent.
Producer, another outstanding job on the board. You know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines and the place we worked and the stories we share. We feel we've truly earned the title of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's all because of you, our callers, listeners, guest, host, and sponsor, REPA, the Retired Eastern Airlines Pilot Association. And we look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again January the 16th, 2017, as we file our flight plan for a destination yet to be determined. We hope that you will have a healthy, prosperous, and happy new year in 2017. Until then, we all say good night, Eastern, and we love you, Eastern, and happy new year.
Good night, Eastern. We love you, Eastern.
Good night.
Happy new year.
Happy new year.
Good night.
Bye, Eastern.